Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, I'm very pleased to have as my guest Vikram Chandra, whose new novel, Sacred Games, has recently been published by HarperCollins. It's one of those novels. It's a city novel. It's about Bombay. And when it was published in India, when was it published in India?
August of the last year, 2006.
Yes. It was an immediate success and occasioned a lot of impressive responses from New York publishers. And now here it is, all 900 pages of it. Tell me, when you began to write it, I mean, people are speaking of this in different ways, but it is certainly the only 900-page thriller that I know.
Right, a very slow-burning one.
Yeah, a long fuse. And I wondered, what was the impulse to fuse the city novel that we know, say, from Ulysses or from Bailey's St. Petersburg, right, with the thriller genre?
I think initially what I was reacting to was the presence of organized crime into the world that I lived in and grew up in ways that it hadn't been present before. And I mean that in its political influence and its grip over certain aspects of the economy, the level of violence which was rapidly escalating, and also in a personal way coming closer and closer to home, in that my family is connected to the film industry in India and they've traditionally been the target of extortion. So I knew people who were getting these calls and getting shot at and wounded, and somebody from my family, my brother-in-law who's a film producer, also faced this. So I started to think of dealing with that. And the initial image I had of it was actually what's in the second chapter of the book, which is a gang boss sitting inside a hardened house talking to a policeman outside. And the sense of fear, I think, that image contained is something that was very much there right at the start. And fear not only in the sense of crime, but also a larger fear that has hung over the subcontinent over the last couple of decades in terms of the political struggles between nation states and, you know, now the nuclearized kind of standoff that we're in. And so when I started working on it, though, still at the time, I thought I was writing a fairly local book about crime down the street from me. But then as I spoke to people, fairly quickly, it became clear that, of course, I would have to deal with politics and its relationships with organized crime locally, but then religion and its uses in these political back and forths, the media, cinema especially, and all of this existing within the context of the great game. I think that the idea of fear dominating one's consciousness and then one's reactions to it led me towards this use of the thriller. And I've always liked using thrillers, and I think one of the interesting things about how we live today is that we face our fear in these fictions in a kind of we face the grotesque and the abject and the terrifying, and yet it works almost like a palliative also, so that we release our fear by confronting it through this. So one other interesting effect is that then it makes fear also unreal to us, reality unreal.
And one of the things that people have not yet been saying about the novel, but when a 900-page book comes out, it takes a while for people to sort it out, is that the people within the book are very influenced by movies and in many ways model themselves,
right.
both their characters and their looks, on figures from the movies.
Yes.
And even there's a second generation of movie stars who have created a reminiscence of the black and white generation of movie stars.
Right.
So we're getting cycles of stories within the movies as well.
Right. So that representations produce representations in turn. And then somebody, some kid sitting in a small town in the middle of the country sees that and absorbs ideas about style and what you should want and attitude. And what I meant also by unreality was that, for instance, Ganesh Gaitonde, who's the big boss in the story, at the beginning tells us about an incident from his life, and then he says, I know you won't believe me because you've already seen this in 6 movies. And that idea, I think, is a theme that interested me throughout the book, was how when some real danger actually starts to enter the lives of these characters, people keep saying things like, well, if this disaster happened in a movie, it can't happen in real life. And when Ganesh Gaitonde, who's on a yacht in Thailand at the time of 9/11, he's called up by one of his men, boss, come up and take a look at what's going on television. And he sees the second plane going into the tower, and the first thing he says is it a film?
Yeah.
So I think that movement that we have as we flicker between belief and disbelief, between rejecting in some sense the reality of the time that we live in and then meditating on it through these fictions, is something that's very much a part of the book.
Now, I noticed that there are at least 3 artist figures within the book who each seem to have a presentation of how narration and representation are presented here. First, or at least the first I noticed, were a group of religious men who are making in chalk a mandala that is largely involved with circles and square geometry, very much like the ashrams, which are built later in the book by a guru. But it's not only religious art, it's art that's going to be washed away. It's being made in chalk. Then there's a young man, the first cohort of our gang lord, who now, many years in prison and crazy, is scrabbling around for paper and colored pencils and drawing cartoons, crowded and very dense, maybe not just because he lacks paper, of his entire life. In fact, he's got hundreds of scraps, and he's only reached 2nd grade by the time we encounter him. And then third, there's a screenwriter who tells us that certain things need to be in the right place. And not only that, that however true a story is, if an audience has already seen it, they're bored by it, and it can't be repeated again. What's more, he tells us and Gaitonde that the appearance of an affectionate, and there is no other kind of mother, an affectionate mother at the end of the movie, having been introduced at the beginning, is a very important component, and indeed the last chapter of this book has such a mother. Now tell me, where are you in relation to these ideas about narration?
Well, I suppose I've always been obsessed, as one can tell from my other 2 books, with this idea of storytelling and with form. And in some ways, I think we biologically depend on our ability to recognize patterns and to make sense of the world by perceiving it to have order. And simultaneously, I guess, we are trapped by them. So we both live by stories and die by stories. So the various kinds of narrative impulse that interested me throughout the book, so for instance, the narrative of the nation state and how those kinds of divisions, that kind of order that is created when you take one people and then draw a line across a geography and a culture and say, now you're two. You know, and so you create this story about both of those places. Then the kind of narrative that all of us try to make out of our lives, when we think about who we were and who we've become, we want to see some sort of sense, a historical kind of sense, out of it. And then religion also then offers us a way of understanding not just our lives, but our place in the larger order of things. As you pointed out, the book itself, in its play with the form of the thriller, the police procedural, weaves all these together in a way that all these other narratives make sense out of the world and our lives to us. And I guess to me it demonstrates that we desperately need stories. We need to make sense out of lives. We need to make those little drawings on pieces of paper and understand what has become of us. So it's a very life-giving thing. It's nurture. It's what we absorb as soon as we begin to understand language as children. Mm-hmm. And it's so much a part of who we are. And then also, in the very making of these stories, you then also separate yourselves. So the story of the tribe or of the nation then becomes something in opposition to somebody else. And the opposite of that, there's a intelligence agent who's slowly losing his mind in a hospital in Delhi in one part of the book. And he thinks a lot about, you know, if you don't have this ability, if you don't have mind, what's left? Are you still there?
Well, in fact, he's losing sort of bandwidths of his mind. There are lesions in his brain. And we're told, in fact, that when we don't have access to our memory, the way our brains are structured, we'll fill in with story things that we don't, in fact, remember.
Right.
That the brain has an obligation to what the book calls making things whole. Mm. And in fact, it's a very various and ironic attitude toward wholeness that the book has. Wholeness can be attained through religious practice. It can be accomplished by memory. The most grotesque version is a woman who is in the course of terrible warfare hacked apart, mm-hmm. and she's perceived as being still whole.
Yeah.
So I wondered if you would talk about the idea these characters have of becoming whole.
Yeah. What interested me, once I actually began doing the research for the book, thinking, like I said, that first it was going to be a book about local events, and then I would be sitting in a police station in Bombay and somebody would say, well, I can tell you about this incident that happened in 1992, but if you really want to understand it, you have to go to Delhi and talk to these other two people about this other larger context. So I became really finally fascinated by this huge mesh of interconnected lives and people and historical forces and organizations in which individual people didn't necessarily understand what was being done to them, why they were being forced to make certain choices, why certain things were happening on their street. And I think that's one of the offerings that art makes to us, is that it makes wholeness for us.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Vikram Chandra, author most recently of Sacred Games. His earlier novels were Red Earth and Pouring Rain and Love and Longing in Bombay. Sacred Games is published by HarperCollins. We'll continue after this short break. I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Vikram Chandra about his new novel, Sacred Games. Now, one of the things that I noticed is that the other kind of wholeness is the pursuit of spiritual wholeness. Mm. And in this case, that's to understand that you're insignificant. Mm-hmm. What the gurus are teaching here is that you are a tiny part of a vast design and that people are like atoms. Mm-hmm. This makes them, at least for the guru who poses an atomic, a nuclear threat during the course of the book, it means that people can die like ants.
Right.
You know, that getting past the ego in this book means being atomized.
Yeah.
Other interpretations, there's a Marxist interpretation of the book as well, that these atoms have to band together to create a proletariat, a class that will overthrow the established order. And that's why I felt that the book was thrilling in its war between different ideas of what constitutes wholeness.
Right. And so all of these stories, these grand narratives, which offer us a vision of change and paradise, depend, I think, on this idea of self-sacrifice. And I mean, as myself, as an individual, I'm not even arguing with that fact, I think, necessarily. I think the guru's ideas, the Marxist-Leninist ideas, have a certain logic that is inescapable and that actually does make sense within its context. But I hope what also the book offers is finally the importance and the value of these individual people and these lives that are caught up in these larger narratives.
Well, in fact, the sections of the book that I found the most moving are, they're called insets,
right.
And they reminded me of the stories in Dubliners, particularly in the way in which when you read Joyce's stories, things that you can't quite know while reading the story, that Eveline has been simply seduced and abandoned by a sailor and that she's weaving a romantic tale around him for the rest of her life. She'll be weaving this romantic tale. We read about a young girl who we know from narration earlier dies young. And we're watching as she writes in her diary about a boy she's met as a servant observes her and says, oh, she's young, let's let her be happy. I'm not going to scold her for being a romantic.
Right.
And as gradually we realize who this is, we say, oh, yes, thank goodness that before her life was cut short, we see this moment in which she can project
An
entire future.
Right. Well, that life of hers is cut short, I should say. She shows up later in the very last inset as the mother of the Pakistani intelligence agent. I don't know if you caught that.
The maid or the?
The sister.
Ah, no, I didn't. Oh, how great. Thank you.
So the old dying grandmother at the end is the woman who disappears from the life of Sartaj's family early in the book, which is actually something that really happened in those times so that women especially were torn from their families, and then some of them, in attempting even to come back, were rejected and sort of found themselves with nowhere to go. But in my imagination, then, that's the paradox of the split between these two peoples, supposedly two peoples, that happens at partition, is that we're very intimately related with each other, even as we oppose each other. And again, this idea of a certain kind of narration, both giving us wholeness in one sense, making us feel like we're part of a community, a nation, and then in that very instance, then dividing us from somebody else.
The section of the book that I found the most extraordinary was a sort of long short story or novella that occurs in the inset called Two Deaths in Cities Far From Home, where we learn that a man who we thought we'd never hear from again, we get sentence by sentence in a way that reminded me sort of Kleist, Michael Kohlhaas, of a tragic story of how this person has been formed from naivete through education to a kind of despair, through despair to politics, from politics to petty thievery. And, you know, he goes through the cycle of this novel in small. The idea of giving us that character really 50 pages before the end of the book, tell me about it.
Well, this is a man who causes what I think is perhaps for me was the deepest loss in the book, which I suppose I shouldn't talk about because people might not have read it. But again, then I was interested in, I suppose, what one could call peripheral characters, you know, which one would treat. For Sartaj, who investigates that loss, the case is closed and no more can be said about that man, even though Sartaj asks the question, why did this happen? And then again, so in that last inset, the two people that you meet again is one is the lost woman and the other is this man who for me resonated together for particular reasons. They're both educated people whose education doesn't protect them from the unfairness of the world or the tragedies that they face. It just makes them more alert to what happens to them. It makes them more sensitive. And also then that especially in the in reference to Adil, who's the young man who goes through all of these things and ends up being a petty thief, again, he's offered a grand narrative about his life that explains to him, at least for a while, who he is and what he should be doing in order to make things better. So while the other person, the woman, is somebody who's caught up in another one of these big stories. But the idea was that finally, when you think the story is over, you cannot have wholeness to the story, the completeness that the mandala demands, without including these two people, who are the forgotten people. They're the two people whose names have been erased from history. And I wanted to recognize them and to include them in the circle to actually give it completeness, whatever completeness it does have.
A final subject, although it sounds inevitable, say, to say so, the hero of the book is Bombay and its people, its neighborhood, its various languages, and the book is full of words that come from the street life of Bombay. It's hilarious in that in American reviews, all sorts of words that can't be used in family newspapers because they've been made exotic are studying the reviews. And I think if the editors knew what these words meant, that is to say, if they looked in the glossary at the end of the book, they probably would not be using these words even in translation. Yeah. But it's the sense of a city and all of the people who speak and intersect in it. And I gather that you spend half the year in Bombay?
Yeah.
Yes. Tell me, you know, given the fact that, how to put it, the city novel, the novel of the home place, is such a staple, almost a requirement a certain kind of literature, how did you dare to come to approach this perennial and eternal concern of the writer with the place with which he comes. Right. And explaining that place, you know, Joyce says, forging the consciousness of my race and the smithy of my soul, you know, all of these things, Faulkner, you know, it's quite a stepping up to the plate.
Yeah.
Tell me.
Well, again, you know, I think I was saved by thinking, at least at the beginning, that I was writing a very small book. Even when the book got bigger, what I realized that I had to do was to not think of those kind of larger questions while I was writing, but try and stay as intimately as I could within the bodies and minds of Sartaj and Gaitonde and all these other people, so that the larger portrait, I guess, that finally people are perceiving comes from, you know, tiny little moments when Sartaj is stuck in a traffic jam, as we all are all the time in Bombay, and he just has to sit there and sweat, right? And so trying to get that physical feeling of actually living day by day in this place, maybe it's an approach that through these accumulation of details finally ends up making a shape, which I guess is also, in a sense, the shape of the book, in that the mandala suggests to the viewer that there are all these disparate elements within the circle, but the artist, by putting them together, suggests connection and asks you to meditate on that. And so in the same way, the book either will seem, I think, chaotic to the reader, or if you do see the shapes in it coming together, then they'll make sense and a portrait, as you pointed out.
I have been speaking with Vikram Chandra, author most recently of Sacred Games, published by HarperCollins. Thank you, Vikram, for joining me.
Thank you so much.
You can read an excerpt from Sacred Games at kcrw.com/bookworm. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The technical director is Mario Diaz, with production assistance from Alan Howard. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
Books are your friends, my friends. Books keep you company. Books take you across the sea and down along a trail that never ends. To the jungles you can go in books. To the land of ice and snow in books. As you ramble through the pages, books will take you through the ages, back to days of old when knights were bold in books.
Books, 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 books. Books. Books can be funny too.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcast the most recent ones from our website. Go to kcrw.com/bookworm. Plus, copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
We'll take you through the ages, back to days of old, when knights were bold in books.
Books, 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 books. Books. Books can be funny, too.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's book of the mouse.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.